It is John Gibson. It's a morning digestion for November 15th. I'm out of town. I thought this was a perfect day to run an interview with an author I did a couple days ago, but a great new book. It's called The Hidden Nazi, The Untold Story of America's Deal with the Devil. And this is about a Nazi named Hans Kammler, who was he was a very big deal in the world of Adolf Hitler. He designed the death camps for their murderous efficiency. He was in charge of the V1 and V2 projects in the sense he was overseeing the Nazi scientists. At the end of the war, when it was clear that Germany was going to lose, he was secretly in charge of planning for the Fourth Reich. And they thought that it would be sort of like the end of World War I. You know, Germany would be punished and then it would rise again. Instead, you know, Hitler killed himself. And Hans Kammler apparently faked his own death by suicide. And the authors believe he ended up probably alive in South America, very well off, and lived to a ripe old age. The authors, there are three of them, Dean Reuter, Colm Lowry, and Keith Chester. And I spoke with Dean Reuter, the principal writer on the book, about the hidden Nazi, the untold story of America's deal with the devil. Mr. Reuter, thanks for taking the time today. Can we just start off, who was the hidden Nazi and what did he do? I realize there's a bunch here, but we can kind of go through his Nazi and World War II career bit by bit. But how about starting with who is this?
Sure, of course. First, let me start by saying thank you, John, for having me on. I really appreciate the opportunity to be on your show, and I appreciate you sharing the time with me. The hidden Nazi, Hans Kammler, it's a story about Hans Kammler, who is an all-powerful, all-evil Nazi SS general who literally helped make the Holocaust possible, and which is an extraordinary thing to say, but it is true. I don't think the Holocaust would have happened or would have happened to the extent it did without him. He was really the personification of evil. But in addition to that, he was also ruthlessly powerful. So by the end of the war, after having, you know, cut his teeth on the Holocaust, as it were, he was in charge of all of Germany's secret weapons, including the infamous German vengeance weapons, the German V1 and V2 rockets, but also Germany's revolutionary jet aircraft, all their special munitions, which included shaped charges and anti-tank proximity fuses, radar research, nuclear weapons, and on and on and on. So that's him in a nutshell, and I can dig deeper into, you know, his role in the Holocaust and his role in overseeing the secret weapons and so forth and so on. But we've never heard about him, surprisingly, although he achieved the highest possible rank within the SS. We've never heard about him because at the end of the war, conventional history tells us on May 9th, 1945, the last day of the war, he committed suicide. But our research has disclosed that's not quite the full story.
Okay, so let's start with that. I mean, just so people know what we're talking about, we'll get into this at some depth. He designed the death camps, literally designed them. He was in charge of, as you said, the V1, the V2 rocket programs, the buzz bomb program. And he also was working on setting up the Fourth Reich, which, as we know, didn't happen. But why is it we don't know about him? Why isn't his name up there with Goebbels and Himmler and Hitler himself?
That's a great question. You know, in doing our research, we were in contact with archives around the world, national archives, with small and large libraries, military bases everywhere where we could find documents. We reached out to the Department of Justice Office of Special Investigation, which is our official Nazi hunting team. We reached out to the Wiesenthal Center and even the Mossad and confirmed that none of them had ever hunted for Kammler. Their response to us was he was dead. We had to pursue living war criminals. We had limited budgets. That was their general response. So not only has Kamler been forgotten by history, he's been forgotten and ignored, never pursued by the Nazi hunters. And it's because he was presumed dead. The German court even adjudicated him dead 3 years after the war at his wife's request. And everybody just believed the suicide, unfortunately. And he's escaped justice and escaped critique by history until our book, The Hidden Nazi.
All right. Now, I'll put that off for a little while. But let's start at the beginning. You say in going over who Hans Kamler was, that he designed the death camps. I presume we're talking about Buchenwald, Auschwitz, and the rest of them. In what way did he design them? What did he change?
Sure. He was in it from the ground floor, actually. The Holocaust didn't begin at the beginning of the war. There were concentration camps in Germany before the war. But what happened during the war, they decided they would convert these concentration camps for the Holocaust. And it was Hans Kamler who helped identify Auschwitz as the site for the main killing camp. He literally laid out the blueprints for expanding camps, the infrastructure of those camps, water supplies, roadways, railways, the meets and bounds of the camps. He negotiated with the local officials about installing these camps at Auschwitz, but throughout the Reich. He designed, he became an expert and really recognized for efficiency. He designed a standardized concentration camp barrack out of cheap wood, basically horse barracks. The design was going to be bricks, more expensive, more difficult to build. And he said, no, we're going to standardize this, have this cheap wooden barrack. We've got the architectural drawings with his name on it. And that became the barracks throughout the Third Reich. We've even got a version of this document, this architectural drawing. He's an architect and engineer by training, where it indicates the number of people that are supposed to be housed within one of these barracks is 550, and that's written over with a stroke of a pen, and the number 774 is inserted there. So what would have been a miserably overcrowded barrack became even more overcrowded with the stroke of a pen. And in the end, the amount of space per person in one of these barracks that he designed was literally the size of a coffin, which is ironic but true. And I want to make sure your listeners understand, as we show in The Hidden Nazi, he wasn't just playing the role of a bureaucrat. He wasn't making these changes from Berlin and sending them out over the wires or something like that. His nickname was Staubwolk, which is dust cloud, which describes him going from one camp to another, to his various construction projects, demanding changes, barking orders, making sure everything was just so. His underlings feared they'd be shot if they didn't comply with him. So that was his role in the camps general. He went on from there, miserably, to design the gas chambers and the ovens at these same camps. Again, not just Auschwitz, but other camps as well throughout the Reich. And we've got document after document that show him in charge of the design and installation. And when there were problems, he made modifications. And he was on site at these camps endlessly. He toured camps through Eastern Europe and the Ukraine and studied methods of killing. It's just remarkable the breadth of power this guy had with regard to the concentration camps. And that was just one sliver of what he would do before the end of the war.
One of the things you point out in the book is that the overcrowding had a secondary purpose, and that was to encourage disease so that there would be less or a reduced need to actually run people through the ovens.
It's true. These camps were designed in a way to fail. I mean, really, the idea of the Holocaust was in tension with the idea of winning the war. If you stop and think about it, every ounce of effort it took to collect people, transport them, enslave them, and keep them alive was effort that could have been used to try and win the war. So this compromise was that, we'll use slave labor, but we'll treat them miserably enough. We will essentially work them to death. And the survival rates at these camps were terrible. I mean, I saw one where 80% of the prisoners at a slave labor camp died in the first 3 months. One other camp that was described as, quote, comparatively good and clean, had a death rate of 27%. So even the best of these camps were lethal.
Before I go on to the V1 project, V2 project, and the Fourth Reich, let's double back to his alleged suicide. You don't believe that he did kill himself?
No, we know he didn't kill himself. I mentioned a German court in 1948 adjudicated that he had committed suicide on May 9th, 1945, at the end of the war. That case was undertaken at the request of his wife. He had children, so his wife could then get a benefit as a military veteran, the wife of a military veteran. She had children as well with him. And this was all based on the testimony of his driver, one of his drivers. There was no identity disc, the equivalent of a dog tag, was ever returned, or his sidearm, or his papers, which would be required practice during the war as evidence of someone's death. No body was ever discovered, and even in post-war searches, they could never find a grave. So his suicide was always suspicious. And years later, a second version of his death emerged, and then a third version. And the folks who I did this book with, Keith Chester and Colm Lowry, we worked together on The Hidden Nazi. They just couldn't believe that he committed suicide. So they kept digging and digging and digging and found definitive documents, official government documents that prove he did not die at the end of the war. His suicide was faked.
So where did he die? How long did he live? Was he in Prague? Is that what your investigators think?
So we do think he was in Prague. We think he made it to Prague because that's another site for secret weapons that he was in charge of. He went there to collect weapons and technology so he could deliver it to the Americans to try and save his own life. That was his deal. Our book indicates that he did a deal with the Americans to try and rehabilitate himself, save his own life. And part of that was delivering things from Prague in terms of technology. And that's where he went. And he supposedly got caught behind enemy lines, but we know that he surrendered to the U.S. Army and lived on.
Well, okay, so what was the U.S. Army's role in allowing him to continue this secret life?
Well, the idea was, you know, as the war's ending, everybody knew Germany was going to lose the war for months in advance, and the Germans were very far advanced in terms of their technology. And there was going to be this mad scramble. Everybody knew that new battle lines would be drawn. The new threat to the United States would be the Soviet Union and communism. And there would be this mad scramble for German technology at the end of the war. And that's what the Kammler deal was about, him delivering rocket technology that actually helped us get on the moon and helped us win the Cold War with the ICBM and other rockets that became part of our arsenal in the Cold War. That was the Kammler deal, delivering that technology in exchange for saving his life, rehabilitating his career.
Well, as long as you brought that up, we're into the V1 and the V2. And Wernher von Braun, who anybody of our age knows from Life magazine, was a star of our space program. But in fact, he was a Nazi rocket scientist. So what was Kammler's involvement with him and Wernher von Braun ending up on the American side instead of the Russian side?
Sure. That was the technology that we wanted, that we scrambled for at the end of the war. What happened was Germany had been working on a rocket program since 1930, in between the wars. And because they started so early, they made advances with Wernher von Braun, their lead rocket scientist, that Americans and the Western allies just thought weren't possible. You know, Germany's beginning to lose the war. It looks like they're going to lose the war. Hitler starts talking about these secret weapons, this super weapon that's going to reverse the war. Everybody believes those were the vengeance weapons, the German rockets, the V1 and the V2. There were actually 100 rockets that the rocket team developed, thousands of rocket scientists. The ones we talk about most today and the ones we feature in the book are the V1, the Buzz Bomb, which itself was not... it was a bit of a revolution. It traveled 400 miles an hour. It would go 150 miles in the air. But it was plywood covered by sheet metal with a diesel engine. But it could deliver a massive payload, a one-ton payload of high explosives and just drop it onto a city like London. And it was used to terrorize cities of London. And so it was something of a revolution in the sense that it enabled Germany to project power even when they didn't control the skies. But the real innovation was the V2 rocket, which was a supersonic liquid-fueled rocket that was so far ahead of its time, it didn't seem to belong on a World War II battlefield. That's the one that Allied scientists thought couldn't even be made. It required the creation of thousands of new parts, all working in perfect coordination and perfect synchronicity, and hundreds of pieces of technology that just didn't exist before the war. One fellow on the team said developing the V2 was like the planning of a miracle, and it was just that sophisticated and intricate. It was a guided ballistic missile, 46 feet tall, just to give your audience a sense of what we're talking about, 14 tons. It traveled up to a height of 55 miles into the atmosphere, and reached a top speed of 3,600 miles an hour. So it was supersonic. It arrived without any warning at all. There were no defenses to it. It would arrive before its auditory signature would. So it could be walking down the street and a city block in London would just be shattered. It unearthed 6 million pounds of debris when it hit and created a massive crater. And that's, debris and shrapnel equal to the weight of about 2,000 automobiles, just to give your listeners some sense of the size of this thing. These were massive explosions, and it could travel just over 200 miles. So again, it's away from Germany. They could and Eastern Europe. They could launch these missiles into Antwerp, into London, Southampton, and terrorize the citizens. It was extremely effective, and we talk at some length about its use on the battlefield. Kollner got control of this because he was so successful at running the Holocaust and proving himself to be a good manager, believe it or not, extraordinarily efficient. And once they had a successful test of the V2 rocket in October 1942, Kammler and Himmler, his boss, reached out and they seized this rocket program and took it over.
I noticed a quote in your book that Himmler speaking to one of the rocket scientists and saying, you have to understand it's not your baby anymore.
Yeah, that was a quote addressed to von Braun, and that was to say this is a military weapon that now is the property of the SS, the dreaded Schutzstaffel, and they were going to use it aggressively. One thing that I thought was fascinating is that, after seizing control of the production of these, Kammler was then put in control of the research, the mass production, and the actual firing of the V2 in the battlefield. And I can't think of any other circumstance where one person on any side of any war had such sweeping power. And that, as it was with the concentration camps, that was just one element of Kammler's control. He kept getting more and more to do. He never gave up things. He never stopped doing things. He just accumulated more and more power and more breadth. But I never had anybody, I could never see anybody with control of a complicated weapon system cradle to grave as he was. Just extraordinary.
So the other aspect of all of this that's fascinating is he was many of the Germans thought that many of the Nazis thought that the end of the war would be a little bit like World War I, where the country would be punished, but there would be time to rise again, and there would be a Fourth Reich. So tell us about the plans for that.
Sure. And it does make sense. You've described the context perfectly. World War I ended suddenly in a surprise defeat, an embarrassing defeat for the Germans. They had gone beyond their borders, conquering territory. They'd never lost a battle, never even fought a battle on German soil, and all of a sudden they give up. Yet, even despite that, they suffer under the Treaty of Versailles, but then they rise again, the Third Reich. And in World War II, they managed to conquer vastly more territory than they ever conquered in World War I. So it's natural. You can see how the German psyche would absorb the idea that we're going to rise again. We go through these cycles. And they began planning. As individuals, you can see we saw lots of evidence of individuals planning their exit strategy, preserving assets, making plans to get out of the Reich. But we also saw plans at the highest level of German government, including German industry. A meeting in the fall of 1944, about a year before the war ended, 9 months before the war ended, really, where German government was telling German industry, get all your assets, all your technology outside the Reich, set up new companies, just get it offshore so that we'll have it for the Fourth Reich. And in addition to that, we found in 1953, so this is 8 years after the war ends, 1953 CIA report, where it reads like an alarm bell, John. The CIA is deathly afraid of a Fourth Reich because they've been down in Argentina documenting the number of Germans down there, the number of Nazis, German enclaves, German towns, like Alpine villages, with German chambers of commerce and restaurants, entire German culture. And they were very fearful that the Fourth Reich would rise again. Obviously, it didn't, but it was planned for. It just never materialized.
Was Kammler given safe haven in the U.S.?
So at the end of the book, we know that we the Americans had Kammler in custody for 10 months after the war, and then his paper trail really just evaporates. It just vanishes. And we're very clear from that point forward, we sort of have to speculate as to what became of him. And frankly, it's our hope that the publication of this book will loosen some more documents. There's a lot of problems getting documents from the U.S. and other governments. But at the end of the book, we spin out different scenarios about what we think happened to Hans Kammler, and we identify one of them as most likely based on some other similar cases that are well documented, that were documented by the Department of Justice in the 1980s. So fascinating stuff.
Let's go to how you discovered all of this, or how you tracked it down. And what I'd like to start with, if you don't mind, I know you had two associates who were very involved in digging a lot of this up, but you yourself got to sit in front of Hans Kammler's son, Jörg. And I'd like you to tell us about that.
Sure. That was a little harrowing, frankly, because I had been in touch with him and my other team members had been in touch with Jörg Kammler. This is the son of Hans Kammler, the Nazi general. By email, but he had never agreed to meet with me. He lives in northern Germany. I was in Germany. I decided I would just take a 2-hour train ride and walk up on his house, which is what I did. I wasn't sure if he'd even be at home, if he'd see me, what the circumstances would be, but I sat with him for quite a while and conducted an interview that I describe in the book, The Hidden Nazi. It was just fascinating. As I mentioned, it's like having real history in front of you. I was thrilled as a researcher and as a World War II buff to be able to hold documents in my hand from 75 years ago, but to be able to talk to somebody who's the son of a Nazi war criminal is just extraordinary. And believe me, that Jörg Kammler has had a complicated life as the son of a missing Nazi war criminal who faked his own suicide.
Well, did he even know his father?
That's a great question, John. Jörg was 5 years old when his father left, so he has very faint memories of him. His mother lived with him until 1996, so to the extent he knew his father, it was really through his mother, who, interestingly, never remarried. It was as if she had him adjudicated dead, and they were still, even after the court adjudication, they were still looking for information on Hans Kammler. So I think they had the court rule him dead so they could get the survivor benefits from the German government. But they never really believed the story of their father's suicide or husband's suicide. And it was very clear when I sat with Jörg Kammler that he was looking for information from me. He wanted to know if I had definitive proof that his father had survived.
There's no way that Hans Kammler is alive today.
No, he would be 118 years old today. So we don't need to be looking over our shoulders.
Okay. Now, but Now, behind all of this that you found out is the effort to find it. And so I'd like you to tell me about your two associates and what they have been doing over many years to track down Hans Kammler.
Sure. Yeah, that I do. I wrote this book in first person, which is a little unconventional for a history book, but I think it really works. And the way I got involved, there's two associates you mentioned, Keith Chester and Dr. Colm Lowry. I've known Keith since college. He approached me about a dozen years ago, 2007, and he had already written and self-published a World War II book. And he came across Hans Kammler in his research, and he started researching him because he couldn't believe a guy like this with this much drive would end up killing himself. And he was, by this time, the multiple versions of his suicide had surfaced. So Keith was unconvinced about the suicide, started doing research, came across on a World War II forum, came across Colm Lowry, who was also researching the same person. And, you know, they were, you know, a bit suspicious of one another. You know, researchers can be that way. But they came to know each other a little bit, started sharing documents. And Keith came to me as a lawyer, I'm a lawyer, to write a collaboration agreement, a legal document, so the two of them could share information faithfully. And I did that. And then Keith started feeding me bits and pieces of the story. And I have to say, I was very, very skeptical that somebody so evil and so powerful could have escaped justice and escaped historical justice, too. I thought even if he got away, somebody would have picked him up by now, picked up his story, that is, picked up his trail and written about him. But nobody had written about him. So I got increasingly involved as they gave me more and more information. And I end up, you know, I went from being skeptic to being the principal author of the book.
Well, you know, I guess the last thing I'd like to talk to you about, and I'm sure you have opinions about this as well as facts, is, you know, especially for someone my age, which is probably a little bit older than you, having grown up as a child of World War II veterans, both my mother and father, you know, I was marinated in World War II lore from a very early age, and the major figures of the German army, the Wehrmacht, the Nazi Party, the Third Reich, are all known to me, and I have never heard of this guy. I never saw pictures in Life magazine that said, "There's Heinrich Himmler. Who's that next to him?" So how did this guy go unnoticed for so long, considering how important he was?
It's a great question. It's a great question, John, and it's one I struggle with today because he was so powerful. I guess the best way to answer that is what he did with the Holocaust. I mean, they really did go after the living war criminals. They wanted to make examples of them, and they really did think that Hans Kammler was dead. Only a handful of people, but some people at very high levels, I think, knew that he had survived. And then, you know, his work with secret weapons all happened in the final year of the war. It's just the state of the records are extraordinary. I mean, there's some organization, but we had to dig and scratch and plead to get records. We even, you know, around the mystery of his disappearance, we even had Freedom of Information Act requests, documents at small libraries, air bases everywhere. And one request in particular, there's three things I'll say about the documents. One, there were two agencies that were very important in our search. One, the OSS, which is the precursor of the CIA. It became the CIA. The OSS, we found out, is missing 5 million pages of documents they destroyed at the end of the war. So that makes it an uphill battle. The other agency that's very important here is the Army Counterintelligence Corps, the Army CIC. And one entire region of them, their records are destroyed from 1945 to 1947. They just don't exist, those records. So it makes it very difficult to trace these people. The other thing I'll say about the records is that we had one FOIA request that was answered by the Department of Justice where they said, "Oh, we have documents on Kammler, two of them. One created in 1969, 35 pages. One created in 1987, 87 pages. And we can't even give you redacted versions of them. You know, if it's classified information or something like that, they'll usually give you 35 pages and a lot of it will be blacked out, but you'll get something. They wouldn't even give redacted versions of those documents. And, you know, they're created 30 or 40 years after the war, after Kamler's supposedly dead, and we can't get those documents. And then we appealed that decision, got denied, and made a second request a few years later. And at that point, the same office said, we don't have any such documents. So.
So lastly, I mean, I always think of something else, but I'll say this is lastly, and we'll see if I think of something else. How do you think he lived his final years?
I think, you know, I, as we suggest in The Hidden Nazi in the book, I think he went to South America with help from the United States. I think he was smart enough. You know, we have evidence of him striking a deal with the United States in November 1944. So that's 6 months before the war ends. He's already making his own exit strategy. He was smart enough to offshore gold, treasure, stolen art, things like that. So I think he lived in relative luxury, but anonymously. The people who left Germany went through what the United States called a rat line. It was an official sort of escape route for Nazis that we recruited the war to use as intelligence assets. I think he would have been among the first people to use that rat line. People always had their names changed when they were dropped into that rat line by the United States. They got new identities. So he lived as somebody else peacefully in South America.
Wow. In other words, he got away with it.
Yeah. He clearly got away with it. I mean, he was never tried.
Yeah. Well, fascinating book. It's called The Hidden Nazi, The Untold Story of America's Deal with the Devil by Dean Reuter, Colm Lowry, and Keith Chester. And we've been speaking with Dean Reuter. I urge you to get the book. It's just out. Once again, The Hidden Nazi, The Untold Story of America's Deal with the Devil. Mr. Reuter, thank you for your time today.
John, thank you. I really appreciate you having me on.
So, isn't that something? I hope this is keeps you occupied for a Friday, because I'm off to see the grandkids, and there won't be a premium podcast this afternoon, but I think this ought to hold you for the day. And I'll be back Monday with a full morning digestion and a premium podcast. Once again, the book is called The Hidden Nazi, The Untold Story of America's Deal with the Devil. It's about the Nazi Hans Kamler, and the author is Dean Reuter.